Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a cardiovascular-worthy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Cardiovascular, as in cardiac or heart, plus vascular, or all the vessels that take blood to and from the heart and to the rest of the body. We just celebrated Valentine's Day, so it follows to have a heart edition of High Truths. The cardiovascular system is associated with your heart rate, blood pressure, heart rhythm, and blood flow. And when you have problems along these blood highways and roads, that could lead to high blood pressure, low blood pressure, irregular rhythms, blockages to vessels that could then lead to heart attack, stroke, and kidney injury. The American Heart Association published a very ignored but very important white paper back in 2020, 5 years ago, about the danger of cannabis to your heart. You can listen to my High Truth episode number 29 with Dr. Robert Page. I've treated patients in the emergency department who had cannabis-associated high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, and a man who went to near cardiac arrest and almost died. He required a ventilator and blood pressure support medications after dabbing high-concentrate THC. When I tell patients that the American Heart Association advises against using marijuana if they have a heart condition, they all say the same thing. No one ever told me that. That's sad, but true. Some patients are extremely grateful to have this information and wish that someone did tell them. The American Heart Association and various organizations have done a great job in getting the word out that tobacco is bad for your heart, and they should do the same thing with marijuana. Recently, an important review article was published in Nature Review Cardiology. The title was "The Relationship Between Cannabis and Cardiovascular Disease, Clearing the Haze." To learn more about the article and the cardiovascular system, I reach out to the author, Dr. Mark Chandy. Dr. Mark Chandy earned his MD and PhD, which tells me he's not just a doctor, but he's also a brainiac. And after medical school, he trained in internal medicine, and then more training in cardiology, and then a fellowship in echocardiology. And then he said to himself, that's still not enough school, I need more training, and enrolled in a clinical scientist training program to study stem cell biology. So now we know that he's not just a brainiac, but he's just off the charts. He publishes research in prestigious journals such as Cell and holds patents to inventions. He works now as an assistant professor at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. His research focuses on the environmental effects on the heart and cardiovascular system. To learn more about Dr. Mark Chandy, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Chandy on January 30th, 2025. Dr. Mark Chandy, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks very much, Dr. Lev.
So I want to start with your background. Thank you so much for joining us. And last minute, it's very exciting. I have a fellow physician on the podcast, which means you chose to go to medical school. And why is that? Did you always want to be a doctor?
I think that's a great question. I always wanted to be a doctor. Since I was really young, maybe in high school is, I think, where I kind of made the official decision. It's always been a dream of mine to be a cardiologist. And I also really like science. And I think that kind of explains why I blended so much science into my training.
So you always, not only did you know you want to be a doctor, you always wanted to be a cardiologist, and you didn't veer from that.
Like there's a lot of great things in medicine. I gotta say, there's just so much variety. And getting into medical school, it was really an eye-opening experience. There's like a merge. There's very exciting. And there's also other things like medicine, surgery, but also radiology. There's just so much variety. I loved all my medical rotations, but like I always had this desire, to be a cardiologist. And I think it when I finally did my first I guess my first rotation as an internal medicine resident, I really loved it. That in ICU, that really pushed me, I think, to commit to that and apply in my first year of internship. But yeah.
That's awesome. So you liked all those chest pain consults.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that it's a very simple history. There's only about 4 or 5 questions you need to ask, and an ECG and some blood work, and it's a very fast, very efficient. It has like a bit of a surgical feel to it, but there's also the internal medicine behind it. So I have a strong history of cardiovascular disease in my family as well too, and diabetes. And so I think that was a big part of the desire, inspiration to go into it. I think, as I learned more and studied more, there's all these unanswered questions. And I always really loved science. Like I used to go out in my parents' backyard into the woods and be collecting frogs and looking at crayfish, and which we have up here. I think that that curiosity kind of never really went away, even though I do like seeing patients. I just like doing both. So
Yeah. So I described you as a brainiac, but then off the chart brainiac, because not only did you get your MD and PhD, and not only did you do cardiology and then echo, and then you kept going for more school. So you must love education.
That's very kind of you. I think that I was really fortunate. I got into Penn State, and I got to basically into a medical science training program track. And so it really funded my education, and gave me a small stipend. So I didn't have a lot of pressures, like to start practicing right away. I think I was really grateful for that opportunity. And I think that you're right. I probably like school a bit too much, maybe. So no, I really enjoy it. And yeah, I'm not sure though if I'm a brainiac, but yeah.
And well, not only that, you married one too, sounds like, because you said your wife is in science as well.
Yeah, she's definitely the better half. If you were to meet her, you might want to actually interview her. She's a bit of a superstar. I think she's got over 100 publications, and she did HIV research in Africa. She's also a Rhodes Scholar, and so she's definitely the better half, smarter than me. And so we share a lab together now, and it's a good way for us to kind of pool our resources as translational clinical scientists trying to translate basic science findings into the clinic. But she's more kind of critical care, intensivist, and so, but with an ID background, infectious diseases background. So she's trying to understand why it is, some people who get COVID, for example, are fine, and why some people are super sick. And can we, triage them and put them on different therapies? But I don't want to talk too much about my wife, because it'll probably get me in trouble. So, but yeah, she's the better half for sure.
Right. So I see it. We got this super science couple. So you work together, live together. Do you work clinically too? Do you see patients?
Yes, so that's how we met, actually. So we met in our residency that way, and I did my internal medicine in Vancouver, and we're both internal medicine residents there, and we were just friends at that point. And then when we went to Toronto, I was in cardiology, and she was in critical care, and I'd be frequently consulting her for help with the vented patients, and they're always really well managed, and I got a lot of compliments from my attendings. And then I think, yeah, even now here at Western, basically, we do have patients that we overlap with, and and our research programs are actually starting to intertwine as well too. So it's very, very interesting.
That's awesome. Awesome. And then when, your resume, not only all that education and research, but you also have inventions and patents. Maybe tell us about one of them.
So yeah, so I've been very, very fortunate, you know, to work in Joe Wu's lab in Stanford. It's a, you know, a huge kind of basically a transformative experience, I think, for me. I learned about stem cell biology there. I didn't really know very much about it there. And you know, while I was there, I was, you know, very fortunate to be part of this discovery that cannabis was associated with cardiovascular disease. And we actually found, you know, very interestingly that there's a natural occurring compound called genestin from soybeans that could potentially block the adverse cardiovascular effects, at least in, you know, our cell cultures and also on our mouse models. And that's something that, you know, doesn't necessarily apply just to cannabis and cardiovascular disease, but may have application, you know, very broadly. You know, people who have high cholesterols are more at risk for having cardiac events, could potentially put them on genestin, and that could be something to lower their cardiovascular risk and prevent heart attacks and strokes.
Genestin with a G.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And
Genestin.
is this an FDA approved medications or substance or?
That's a good question. It's actually something that is naturally occurring from soybeans, and so it's an herbal remedy, if you will, a natural health product, and it's something that the FDA does regulate. So natural products are something that the FDA, you know, kind of rigorously looks into, but it's something, you know, that you could pick up at Costco. Maybe Costco or Amazon, and you know, just order Amazon definitely. It's used for a variety of ailments. You know, basically people who are with metabolic syndrome, it can actually help lower their glucose or hemoglobin A1C, decrease their body weight. It's also really good for the vasomotor activity in postmenopausal women as well too. So it's used
Is
for
it
a variety of
do you
things.
recommend that to your patients?
So you know, like I think that we have a lot of data from the preclinical aspect of things from the cell culture and in mice. It works in mice. We look at, you know, mice and transgenic mice, they develop plaques in their arteries just like humans do. And we can actually see that when we treat with genestin, it causes the plaques to get smaller. So basically, you know, I think it could be helpful for people with cardiovascular disease. So it's something that needs to, you know, have a clinical trial to sort of really test it. That's something that, you know, I'm working on. And I think that, you know, if we have like some good strong evidence from that it's safe and that it's effective, then yeah, I would make a recommendation for that. Right now you can just purchase and start taking it. But I think it really needs to have a bit more evidence behind it before, and also safety studies done as well too, to make sure that it's both safe and effective.
I love this conversation because you're honest as a physician, and so many people say, "Oh, this is good for you," and they rush to the store and buy psychedelics because it may help their PTSD, and don't realize how much harm they may be causing themselves, as well as how the impurities and the studies aren't done, and here you are, you know, being honest about that, and because that's how medicine should be. That's the point of being medicine versus snake oil.
Oh, thanks very much, Dr. Lev. You know, I think that you know, it's probably something that is harmless. Like it's a basically a food-based derivative, like a soy-based derivative, and you know, lots of people consume it. It probably is harmless, but you know, I think, you know, until we have that evidence, you know, it's really hard to sort of justify you know, somebody, you know, taking money away from, you know, other drugs and medications and putting it into a you know, a soybean derivative. It could be that, you know, it may not be effective in humans because, you know, sometimes there are things that we discover from, you know, cell culture and mice, and it doesn't always translate into the clinic. So, but I'm optimistic about it. But
Okay.
let's see.
Let's talk about the article that led me to you, published in Nature Reviews Cardiology, The Relationship Between Cannabis and Cardiovascular Disease, Clearing the Haze, Clearing the Haze. Did you come up with that?
That was, I think, something that came up while Joe and Neri and I were emailing back and forth, and we're trying to come up with a good title for the review article. And yeah, it's it was a yeah, it was like a it was a really like a pleasure writing it. And I think that and also like a huge huge honor to publish it in Nature Cardiology Reviews. And so and to have that type of audience to I think try to inform and educate about cannabis, because I think as you were saying, there are a lot of things that we don't know about drugs like cannabis or psychedelics, and really haven't ever been studied. And the data is just emerging, so it's a very exciting time in that sense. I think like there's a lot of new things that are coming out, a lot of new data. When I started these projects in Joe's lab 10 years ago, when cannabis was first legal in 2016 in California, there was nothing there, and it was promised to be something that could cure all these neurological ailments, be good for cancer, be neutral for your heart, or beneficial even for your heart. And so I think over time there's more and more epidemiological evidence coming out. And I think that our paper that came out, because we're using preclinical models, we might have come to some conclusions a little bit earlier, but they're all sort of coming out in the clinical literature. So, and this was a nice way to sort of add to what we had already done, and sort of show, I guess, like a more of a complete picture, from the preclinical to the clinical, that cannabis could potentially be bad for the heart and for people, and it may go beyond just the heart as well too.
Yeah, I put that stronger instead of could be. It is, right? We have that evidence that, and the body counts in the emergency department visits, to show that. But your article had started out kind of with an explanation of the endocannabinoid system, because that's where cannabis works, that's where marijuana works. The endocannabinoid systems affects the memory, mood, pain, metabolism, and the cardiovascular. Maybe can you give us a little lesson about that? Because also, like you said, 10 years ago, we just kind of were discovering this whole system.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So cannabis is a very complex mixture of all these cannabinoids, but we actually have something similar to that called an endocannabinoid. And the way our body is set up is we're able to react to those. We have something called cannabinoid receptors. And so those are the known receptors, are cannabinoid receptor 1 and cannabinoid receptor 2. And they're expressed throughout your body, but by far the most are in your brain. And as you were saying, whenever we anything associated with memory, learning, satiety, those sort of things, is really influenced by endocannabinoids in your brain. And so there was a lot of hope that drugs that block these cannabinoid receptors could be used to treat things like obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, even cardiovascular disease. But for a variety of reasons, it's been very difficult to harness those drugs because they penetrate into your brain so well and cause the opposite of all those effects. They cause anxiety and depression, and so unfortunately they were trialed and pulled from the market. But even in your cardiovascular system, you have the cannabinoid receptor 1 and cannabinoid receptor 2, or CB1 and CB2. And very very from a very simple kind of like 30,000 foot view level, when something binds on the CB1, it promotes atherosclerosis or plaques building up. And when something binds on the CB2, it's like it's the opposite. It actually promotes vascular quiescence. So you have this kind of yin and yang sort of effect in your cardiovascular system. And you can imagine if you take something like THC, which is a CB1 agonist, or some of the synthetic cannabinoids, which are very potent CB1 agonists, they kind of put things out of balance. And so you have more plaque forming activity going inside your cell walls, your vascular cell wall, and less of that vascular quiescent activity. It tries and brings everything back to normal. So that's sort of my perspective as a cardiologist. But yeah, it's very complicated. There's probably other receptors involved in it too, but it's our own natural endocannabinoids that govern and regulate our body. But it's when we have those plant-based cannabinoids exogenously over produced or over over introduced into the body that people might have probably do have adverse effects.
Yeah. So are these cannabinoid receptors said mostly in the brain, also in the spinal cord, in the immune system, but they are they in the heart and on your heart vessels as well?
So yeah, so that data comes from the basic science data, I think. And when you look at endothelial cells, which are the cells that line your vessel wall, they express CB1 and CB2. It's also expressed in smooth muscle cells, which are inside your vessel wall and allow to maintain pressure in your arteries and perfuse all your organs. So and it's a big part of what we call the pathogenesis or the process of making plaques in your arteries. So yeah, definitely it's in your cardiovascular system. And even and it's not as well expressed in the actual cardiac tissue itself, like the cardiomyocyte. But it's still there in some small proportion. So yeah, it can definitely affect the heart. And there's a lot of clinical evidence to support that it causes heart attacks, strokes, arrhythmias, and can also be implicated in heart failure as well too.
Wow. So the effect of it is not just as a stimulant, right? So you use marijuana, especially the high potency stuff, and then that raises your heart rate, raises your blood pressure, and can screw up your rhythm, right? SVT, atrial fibrillation. We've seen this in the emergency department. So there's that direct, like I would say, sympathetic effect, is one aspect. Is that right?
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. It has this profound effect on your sympathetic system, and basically you have tachycardia and hypertension, and then followed by bradycardia and hypotension. And so all those big shifts in your heart rate and blood pressure can cause a lot of damage to your vasculature as well. So we call it shear stress, but basically things are just moving along so quickly they're damaging your vessel, especially where they branch off the bifurcations. And so that's where people are more likely to develop plaques that cause heart attacks and strokes. And so yeah, that's a big component of it as well.
So that it's a sympathetic effect on the cannabinoid system that affects the cardiovascular system. But are you also saying that there's another component to it, which is producing more plaque, more blockages in your vessels?
Yeah, no, it's a it's probably like many things going on at the same time. Like with like for example with cocaine, when people take cocaine, it causes high blood pressure, tachycardia, that sympathetic overdrive. But at the same time, it's also causing the platelets to be more sticky and form clots. And at the same time, it's probably causing inflammation in the cardiovascular cells, the endothelial cells that line the vessel. So sim like and we know that cocaine is very bad from a cardiovascular perspective. There's actually a study that was done out of Harvard by Deepak Bax's group and DeFilippis, and they showed that when people who young people who came in under the age of 50, they were more likely to have heart attack and strokes and death from cocaine and also from marijuana. And very interestingly, they did complex statistical analysis, and they found that independent of smoking, cannabis use was had a higher risk of causing cardiovascular events than smoking. It was independent of smoking and actually had a higher risk of causing events than tobacco smoking. So.
Wow. That's so important. And I just want to empower you because the whole world knows that smoking is bad for your heart. And you should be able to say that using marijuana is bad for your heart instead of like, maybe it'll have an effect, could, if we're able to, if we're able to say it for tobacco and you're just telling me this is worse than tobacco, then you should be able to say it.
And I should, you're absolutely right, Dr. Lev. I think, just like tobacco, it's a function of how much you smoke tobacco, so how many years you smoke it for, and also the dose, how many packs, your pack, your history. Same thing with cannabis, right? And so the higher doses they're finding from studies are associated with more cardiovascular events, and most likely the longer that people smoke it, the more likely we'll be seeing cardiovascular events in the future. So yeah.
So I want to understand a little bit more in depth about the heart. I know from cocaine, right? The patients come to the emergency department with chest pain. They have EKG changes. Their CK troponins are a little elevated. They had a heart attack from it. Usually it's not from plaque, right? For cocaine, that's more vasospasm because of that sympathetic surge. Now, is that different with marijuana, where it's from plaque?
So, it's a really interesting question, Dr. Lev. And so, like with marijuana, it can be many different things, actually. So in young, very, very young people, they can have heart attacks from using a lot of marijuana in a very short period of time. And what they find in those studies, when they do the angiograms to look for blockages, there are no blockages. And so it might actually be a vasospasm effect that's going on there. That being said, there's probably generally like very, very true atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease that probably occurs over years of use, just like with tobacco, with the pack years, however many pods of either vaping or blunts or whatever you're smoking, all that cumulative effect is causing inflammation, low levels of inflammation in the vasculature. And as a result of that, the vasculature doesn't like that, and it becomes dysfunctional. And the pathology is the inflammatory cells will come in, and cholesterol plaques will form, just like with tobacco use. So I think that that's probably also a huge component of it, but probably in older patients. But it's definitely like a huge problem with younger people. We can see people like from many papers now, people who are young under the age of 50, if they smoke or vape cannabis, they're much more likely to have cardiovascular events than those that don't.
Wow. And then the third component, besides the sympathetic reaction that we talked about with high heart rate, blood pressure then dropping, or the plaquing effects, there's also direct toxicity to the heart muscle, right? We see this a lot in San Diego as the methamphetamine capital of the United States, where we see young people under 50 who have, horrid heart failure, have AICD monitors because they using meth that directly damaged that was their heart muscles. Methamphetamine does that, cocaine does that. Interestingly, heroin and opioids do not do that to the heart muscle. What about THC? Is that directly toxic, cardiotoxic, or not?
So that's an excellent question, Dr. Lev. And I think it all goes back to the basic science. But the long and the short of it is that clinically, people who use cocaine are more likely to have heart failure. But it seems to be what we call ischemic. It's a problem with the plumbing, with the vasculature. And so people have big blockages, they have heart attacks, and that's what causes the cardiomyopathy, or the weakness of the heart muscle causing heart failure. So it's not something that's directly toxic. I believe it's not something directly toxic, based on the fact that when you look at the receptors, they're more in the vessels and not actually in the muscle, the heart muscle itself, and the cardiomyocytes. But cannabis is a very complex mixture, and there's over 100 different cannabinoids in it, and people are using different components of it now because they can evade the DEA and the FDA because they're unregulated in things like hemp, if they extract it from it. In addition to that, we have synthetic cannabinoids, so that probably are not well studied. So it's hard to say, really, but based on the clinical literature that's coming out right now, it seems to be, people who have heart failure, it's more ischemic from, problems with people having heart attacks and then having heart failure. So rather than a problem of a intrinsic cardiomyopathy, a problem with the actual heart itself.
Okay, good to know. The other things that you kind of, you talked about, you just kind of mentioned these hemp-derived products. I guess nomenclature, I think, you know, the Farm Bill made all these products legal and they call them their hemp-derived, but we really found out from the FDA that none of them are from hemp. They're all made in a lab and they're like semi-synthetic cannabinoid. None of them are really hemp. And that was just a loophole in the law that said, that made anything less than 0.3% Delta 9 THC can be defined as hemp. And so they said, okay, we got Delta 8, Delta 10, we got all these other things that and defined it as hemp, even though they never came off a farm. And now sadly, our young people are the lab rats, and I guess you're the researcher for those lab rats. So what is that? What is the research telling you about that?
You know, Dr. Love, you're very, very well read, and you know your legislative bills very, very well. So I the Farm Bill is something, you're absolutely right, that circumvents the DEA and the FDA because of the 0.3%, as you said, and these compounds can be extracted, and using very simple sort of heat and acid sort of chemical reactions, they can convert delta 9 and CBD, which is pretty much unregulated, I think 48 out of the 50 states. And so they can convert those into other cannabinoids, which have psychoactive effects. So, which is, I think, probably why most people are consuming it. But, you know, it also stands to reason if a person is having those psychoactive effects or psychedelic effects, they're probably also having adverse effects in their cardiovascular system as well, too. So yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't know. You know, it's something that we're studying in the lab and trying to understand from a preclinical perspective. You know, I don't know. There's a lot of young people, there's been a huge increase in the usage of these other cannabinoids like Delta 8, Delta 10, HHC that, you know, have a psychedelic effect. And we don't know what the effects are in these individuals. And unfortunately, these things take time. It's just like with smoking. You know, doctors used to smoke in the 19th century, early 20th century, told everybody it's healthy. Soldiers got in their pill boxes in the First World War and
the head of the camp. My favorite picture is the head of the Cancer Society smoking.
Yeah, no, and then there's like a tsunami of all of these, you know, lung problems, cancer, and then, you know, cardiology, cardiovascular disease came, you know, decades later. You can see once people recognize, you know, once they made this the announcement that there is an association between tobacco and cardiovascular disease and the lungs and cancer, then, you know, you could see decrease in usage, but it took several years for things to get better. So I think unfortunately we're in that situation right now where we may not see the effects for many years. So yeah, but it.
Yeah, although so we have enough effects to make smarter drug policy now, right? When a baby gets into it because of their mom's Delta product and dies, I think that tells us enough, right? We don't need 20 more years of research to know that that's not good for children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely. I think that the gummies, you know, are something that, you know, I have children as well, too, and they look like the gummies that my kids would get in their vitamins, and, you know, they always want to have more than one of those. And so it's very easily for them to overdose on that. And you're absolutely right. You know, they can get into a situation where they overdose and arrest, and elderly people as well too, they can be quite sensitive to it as well. So, yeah, so for a variety of reasons, it needs to be more regulated. And even with the, you know, the other derivatives, the Delta 8 and Delta 10 and HHC, I think some states are starting to regulate it more. The cannabis bills are at the state level are starting to realize that it is a problem. It's, you know, gone from, you know 5 or 6% of the population using it to like 25% in some areas. These
do you have them in Ontario too?
So it's, you know, here everything's legal. So
Oh.
I think that probably. And there are different reasons why people might want to use Delta 8 or Delta 10 or HHC. So Delta 8 in particular, it's thought to ha cause a milder high, a milder psychoactive effect. So you might be might think you might be able to drive or work while you're using the drug and not be impaired. And you might and it's very, very difficult to associate you know acute marijuana use with toxicity. It's you know there's a field sobriety test that people can use, but you know the predictive value of that is you know intermediate at best. You know there are more innovative ways coming out, like Hound Labs use a breathalyzer to detect it in the field if someone's intoxicated or someone's intoxicated at work. But it really is difficult to say if somebody is acutely intoxicated with THC or whether they've you know because they could ta say I've taken it you know several days ago. So enforcing that I think is also a huge problem.
An issue, right? So tell me about writing this article. You obviously did like a big literature re review. You have your own clinical experience, kind of that maybe that motivated the article. Did you learn anything that surprised you?
I think that yeah, I always learn and every time I read and it's always great to have you know these opportunities to review the literature and go through everything and yeah, I was kind of amazed at how quickly you know there's a paper from Jeffers and Jaha, which is basically the American Heart Association journal and it was quite impressive. It showed that you know individuals are more likely to have stroke, 42% actually higher than heart attacks. It's in the mid 30s, I believe, and ischemic cardiovascular disease, you know, in the 20% higher than a regular population if you use marijuana. And they found that dose dependent effects. So the more you smoke, the more you vape, the more you use cannabis, the more likely you are to have cardiovascular disease. You know, I always try and read broadly and you know learn more about how cannabis is affecting other things and you know the effects of cannabis you know with pregnant women. So a lot of women might consume marijuana because it might have an antiemetic effect. It makes them less nauseous. And if they're pregnant, no one knows what the effects of marijuana might be on the fetus, on the child. And you know, I think it's very
Well,
interesting.
I think we do. We have the research on what it does to the child, right? Intrauterine growth retardation, miscarriages, and also long term on the ABCD studies, long term study have seen that women who've used marijuana while they're pregnant, those children years later grow up, and those children are more anxious and have more mental health issues.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dr. Lab. You really know your stuff, and I think that you're absolutely right. It is true that there are you know cognitive effects and psychiatric effects from those in uterine exposures, and there's also fertility effects as well too. More in males actually, I believe, than in females. So it's a and I think what I found to be most interesting was the increase in cancers because you know there was a strong belief I think that cannabis might be good for treating cancer, and actually there's associations now with you know head and neck
Did you
malignancies
see
and
that eightfold or something for laryngeal cancer? Yeah.
no, it was quite impressive and I but I think it makes sense, right? I mean it's an unfiltered it's everything that's you know associated with smoking or vaping but also the cannabis as well too. So I think it's very, very interesting to read about all these potential you know extra cardiac effects of cannabis and but yeah no the associations of heart rhythm problems I also found to be very interesting. There's a big Danish study that came out that showed that even people taking oral cannabis were more at risk for having atrial fibrillation, you know, which can cause stroke and other you know thromboembolic
That is
events.
so
So
important. I don't think the public realize. I don't think even me, who's really into this, when people say, "Well, is it okay if I use edibles instead of smoking?" This for people who have like cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, or for people who have lung problems, right? We've had treated patients who had pneumothorax or pneumomediastinal before, for after smoking so much, and they still have an addiction, so they want to do something and they use the edibles instead. Or sometimes doctors even say, "We'll use the edibles instead." That may be better for your lung, but I don't think it would be better for your heart, because you're still getting all that in your bloodstream.
Yeah, I mean, it's like very controversial. I mean, there is some, you know, mouse work that was done that showed it might actually be anti-inflammatory in the heart. But, you know, like there are people who are doing, you know, good research in the States. Matt Springer is at UCSF, I think, presented some data at the AHA meeting last year that suggested that even when you take in oral, you're actually causing dysfunction of your arteries, and it is inflammatory as well too, I believe, based on his preliminary data. So all things that would, you know, make people more likely to have heart attacks and strokes. But it is, you know, I think you're right. You know, you're not smoking and inhaling all that tar and soot, but you are still getting the THC and the other cannabinoids, and in probably in a smaller dose, but you're still getting it, and it's still having that harmful effect.
Yeah. You're still getting that sympathetic surge and the immunoplacking effect, right?
So yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely causing plaque buildup, and it's, you know, I would think it would cause plaque buildup, and it definitely causes the sympathetic surge. So all things that would set people up for, heart attacks and strokes.
Right. At least three times I could count in my career, we've had a stroke code. Come to the emergency department, we do everything, get the CAT scan, neurologist, lab work, everything is normal. And people are like, "Oh, I wonder what happened." And then we found out, one guy actually showed us like the little gummy that he took. It was called Hangover Remedy. And he go, "Could this be it?" And it's like, yeah, that could be it. That we know we do this whole workup and kind of ignore. We ignore it. It's like, "Oh, it's just weed." It's like, wait a second. If you told the patient that and they understood that, they won't do it again. If you don't say anything to the patients, they'll keep doing it.
I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Lev. And there's data coming out all over the world, like in Canada, even, you know, I think Canada, they had a huge increase in using cannabis during the pandemic, and then more cardiovascular events that followed after that. And you're absolutely right, you know, acutely ingesting a lot of cannabis can predispose someone to having a heart attack or stroke, and the hemodynamic shifts are pretty significant. So I think the data is emerging around the world that it's bad, and you know, I should probably be more strong with my language, and I do encourage people though not to smoke and not to use cannabis, and but I think that it's one of these things. Despite all the knowledge that we have about tobacco, some people still choose to smoke.
But they're making an informed decision. Are smokers making our informed decision? They know it's bad, right? But when you have a patient in the emergency department that are there with chest pain and they have high blood pressure, then, you know, it's very helpful for the doctor to say, you know what, this is not for you. The American Heart Association says that using marijuana products is not good for your heart. And patients say, "Wow, no one ever told me that." And a lot of people say, "Thank you."
Yeah, no, Dr. Lev, you're absolutely right. I think that I think it is important to educate patients, and you know, hopefully educate, you know, the younger generations, you know, that basically that this is something that, you know, if they choose to do it, there could be serious consequences. So, right. An informed decision, I think, and with cannabis, it is an informed decision with tobacco, but with cannabis, I'm not sure if...
Yeah, patients don't know that, right? Anyway, I want to empower the cardiologists out there, you and your colleagues, to make that statement, because people will listen to you. I think that's important. So what are your conclusions from this paper?
So... I think it's an interesting sort of phenomenon that around the early 20th century during Prohibition, all these things are being banned, and now we have this change in the perception of marijuana and cannabis over the last really since the 60s and 70s. There's been kind of like a softening in attitudes towards it, and this belief that it might be a soft drug and not like a hard drug, and I think that it's first became decriminalized, I think, in California in 1996, in the mid 90s, and then later on legalized. And a lot of other people, a lot of other countries, states have done the same thing. And I think that when that legal impediment goes away, I think a lot of people in their minds, there's like a big change in perception, because I think that they think that the government is saying it's okay to use these drugs, and in fact they might be safe, but we really don't know a lot about them. And I think one of the nice things about this is, maybe it's a little too broad, but we talk about all the adverse cardiovascular events that can happen, whether it be with heart attacks, strokes, or rhythm problems, or heart failure, and the basic science understanding of that to date. So I think that I hope we've done a good job of trying to communicate to people that this is a growing problem, and that there is a very strong association between cannabis and cardiovascular disease, and in fact stronger than tobacco. I think that, I hope that people will listen to it, and it might inform people about decision making, policy making in the future.
Yeah, I think what it does, it probably doesn't affect individuals, but it should affect, hopefully it affects cardiologists and the American Heart Association, and make a campaign to educate patients. I think that would be important. You have the data now to make that education and for people to make informed decisions at least. The other thing that I don't think your paper touched on, but I just wanted to discuss with you, is drug interactions. So when I have patients, and especially elderly patients, are usually on some type of medications, and they say they use CBD or THC just a little bit, just to sleep, just sometimes, not all the time. And I'll say, well, let's just make sure it's safe for you first. Go to drugs.com, click the drug interaction checker. Put in your lisinopril that you're taking for your blood pressure, and then now add cannabis and read for yourself. And there's serious drug interactions, right? So and I'll have them, patients do, I don't do it for them. I have them, make them do it on their phone, so that way they could teach their friends, and then they read it. And they're, I had one patient came in. It's usually the weird complaints, like I'm a little dizzy, I'm a little weak, I don't feel right, something's wrong. And it's like, okay, well, I'll do a big expensive workup and get some blood. I had one lady says, but just read this because you just took a gummy that her son or someone gave her. And she read the symptoms, and they described exactly what she was feeling. And she's like, okay, I don't need any of that stuff. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. That's one thing that I think we didn't cover, and it is a significant problem, because cannabis affects the CYP metabolisms in your liver, and as a result of that, it can change the bioavailability of your drug, the pharmacokinetics of the drugs that you're taking, and it can be very, very bad potentially. So I think that yeah, no, that is something that further complicates people taking cannabis, like especially if they're elderly and they're already on several other medications. This is just one more thing that may make things worse.
Yeah. So that's interesting. All right. Well, you got you'll be working on this for a while, because your research in general is looking at the environment and the cardiovascular system. And you mentioned that heart disease runs in your family, and it doesn't in mine too. So I'm going to ask you some questions that are like home related. But yeah, my husband had a heart attack at 53, and then a stroke a few years later, and we learned that like the whole family has lipoprotein A, even my skinny little kids. So So I guess I have a personal vested interest in cardiovascular health. But that's what you look at. You look at the environment and cardiovascular system with stem cells. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what all that means?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that the type of stem cells that I work on are a very special type of stem cells. So when people think of stem cells, they think of embryonic stem cells derived from a fetus. And, you know, there's all kinds of feelings, emotions, and ethical concerns associated with that. But, you know, there is a scientist, Dr. Yamanaka, who revolutionized everything, you know, 20 years ago when he found that you could take a mature cell, like a skin biopsy sample or a blood sample, and make them into stem cells using basically recombinant factors. So you reprogram the cells into basically stem cells, and so those stem cells are very, very interesting because you can make as much of any type of tissue. Like, they don't, you know, become people. They're not totipotent. They can't become people like people walking off the plate, but you can make them into an unlimited source of cardiac tissue. And I'm always biased because I'm a cardiologist, and, you know, we can use that for studying different diseases. So, you know, for example, if somebody has a cardiomyopathy, they may have a mutation that causes the cardiomyopathy, and we might be able to take their blood, make them into stem cells, and make them into the cardiomyocytes, and we can study them in a dish to try and understand it better and maybe come up with better ways to diagnose and treat it. So we call that disease modeling, or Joe's lab kind of defined that as disease modeling, where you can take a sample from someone, and it's very much at the heart, I think, of precision medicine, where, you know, for that one individual, you might be able to understand their disease and diagnosis and treat it and treat them. So I think that it's a very powerful system. And now, like, I think, you know, people are trying to leverage it for drug discovery, you know, with AI, and, you know, trying to use it as a platform for drug screening, because, you know, AI can generate all these different compounds, and we could potentially use the iPSC derived tissue to try and create new drugs. You know, I think I'm most interested, I think, in trying to understand, you know, the effects of, you know, different cannabinoids, novel cannabinoids on the cardiovascular system, like Delta-8 and Delta-10, and also looking at interactions between tobacco and cannabis in vitro, like in a cell culture-based system. And I think that, you know, that's something that's also very interesting, because a lot of people who smoke tobacco also smoke cannabis, and they're probably both bad, but, you know, when we put them together, they're probably a lot worse. And so I think those are things that I can study in a dish, and also in small animal models, and hopefully be able to come up with, you know, different tests and different drugs to treat cardiovascular disease.
By the way, that's fascinating. As you were talking, I was like, oh my God, do the drug dealers know how to do that? The drug cartels, are they going to use AI to make new, stronger, worse drugs than fentanyl? Hopefully it's too complicated for them.
No, I don't know. I think that you know, AI is something very, very new, but it is very, very helpful for you know, if you know what a drug looks like, its structure, you know what it binds to, you know, then the AI can generate all these different compounds, and at least in a virtual world, be able to say it works. And that's also often very helpful. And then, you know, to use, you know, often people in the past would use animals, and not everything studied in animals would translate to the clinic. But the hope is, you know, using stem cell derived tissue, you might be able to accelerate the development of drugs into the clinic, and because it's human based tissues, and it may also contain, you know, the mutations and the other things that actually cause the disease. And so we might be, you know, one step closer to, you know, treating diseases in a very precise way.
Is that already being done, or is that just now in the lab and in theory?
It's a, you know, it's a bit of both. So I think that, you know, I, when I, left Stanford and Joe Wu's lab, they, I had a very big biobank of stem cells with different disease types. But the AI hadn't really emerged the way it has over the last couple of years. And it really has developed quite a bit, and it's quite impressive. Like in the clinic, we can use it for a lot of things. Like I do echocardiography as well too, like ultrasounds of the heart to look at heart function. And now AI can help us with, determining how well the heart is pumping, and help us, even with the scanning, where to position the probes. So, and these are all emerging, into the clinic. The types of things that I was describing for drug discovery are more for, research based, and they're in development right now, but they're quite promising, and they are coming up with new candidate drugs to treat things like cancer and hopefully cardiovascular disease as well too.
Interesting. The other part of, like you said, that your mission for your research is biomarkers. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. One of the other patents that I had was trying to basically come up with a way to predict if somebody might be likely to have diabetes. And so diabetes, generally speaking, is thought to be an environmental thing. And after you live a certain number of years, you develop the type 2 diabetes and have insulin resistance. But some certain individuals, they may be more prone to it. For example, if both your parents have diabetes, you have a 50% chance of developing diabetes. So there probably are genes that are associated with it. So I developed basically a stem cell based biomarker, if you will, for predicting if somebody could have diabetes. I did it with like a lot of other talented colleagues, of course, in Joe's lab. So we came up with an algorithm based on gene expression in a person's stem cells to predict if they might develop diabetes in the future. Perhaps like a simpler example of that might be, when someone's having a heart attack, we do blood work, and we look for basically a marker that's associated with heart damage.
Are you looking talking about the CK and troponin?
Exactly. Yeah, you look at the troponin. So the troponin is very specific to the heart. The high sensitivity troponin is very, very sensitive and very specific to the heart. And so that's basically just like a test to diagnose somebody with a disease and maybe even prognose how the disease is progressing.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, that's very interesting, fascinating. I was thinking, have you seen the research from Stuart Rees out of Australia? He does these large studies on population showing that how genotoxic THC is. I don't know if that applies to your research, but I was thinking about that when you were talking about how males are more susceptible because it affects the sperm, and he has large studies to show that. And but I think his data is more epidemiological. Yeah, you may want to take it to your petri dishes.
No, that's really interesting. I wonder if there is like toxicity caused by the THC, by the marijuana at the genetic level. I would certainly think like at the epigenetic level, the chromatin, everything probably gets modified in a bad way, and that's why we develop cardiovascular disease. But yeah, I'd be very interested
I think that
to.
explains to me, my simple non-brainiac mind, is why there's a higher rate of testicular cancer, especially the genetic kind of testicular cancer, twofold increase in men who use marijuana. And that, I mean, if it affects the sperm, then that would explain that. But yeah, he shows this as genotoxic, and not just for, but it's multi-generational, right? Because if there's changes in that DNA, it passes on. It doesn't fix itself.
Yeah, no, I think that if cannabis is causing damage at the genetic level, then unfortunately, what what a person does, their children or their, maybe several generations are affected by it. And so, yeah, that's yet another reason not to do it. But that would be a very interesting thing to study in a dish, and to sequence as well too. That's a very, very good. I wonder if someone's working on that already though.
I don't know, but if you want me to connect you two of you, I'll be happy to.
That'd be great.
Yeah, we still have it now, but at COVID we quickly developed the drug Paxlovid, right? And so if you were older, you met the criteria of being prescribed Paxlovid, we would even provide it free, the United States government. But one of the warnings was, especially for men, is not to reproduce for a few months after taking Paxlovid because it was known to be genotoxic. And I remember doing that and prescribing that and thinking, well, shouldn't we do that with pot too? It's the same thing.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Like young people tend to use marijuana, and then and if they're using marijuana and they become pregnant, then the adverse effects could be huge, right? And so I think that and to think that then we propagated on through multiple generations is just awful. So but I think that should be something that people should be made aware of. And I completely agree that it's a huge problem, especially in a young population.
Yeah. So what do you want to tell your fellow cardiologist, and what do you want to tell the patient population?
So I think for my fellow cardiologists, I want to tell them, I hope that, after, if they have the chance to read the paper, that's great. But I would hope that they would, I guess try to inform their patients and their colleagues that cannabis is strongly associated with cardiovascular disease, and it's something to be avoided, just like tobacco. I think with patients, there's always an element of choice or informed consent, I think, as you mentioned before, and I think that people have the right to choose, but they should be aware that there are many, many adverse effects of cannabis that are cardiovascular, but even extend beyond the cardiovascular system, as we're talking about with reproduction, potential effects causing cancer, genetic toxicity. There's like a whole slew of things that that it may cause, and it's, the data is coming out that there is very strong association. So I hope that people would bear that in mind before they choose to use marijuana.
That's great. Well said. Dr. Mark Chandy, thank you so much for your paper, for your work. I'm excited for you. You and your wife should be full professors and get a lot of research done with this dynamic duo team, and wish you much success and health.
Thank you very much, Dr. Love, for the opportunity to talk today. And thanks for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.